Hi, everyone, and welcome to Academic Dean, where we connect with passionate college leaders who share their stories and viewpoints of higher education, especially lessons learned along the way. Now, here's your host, Dr. Dave Gercheck.
Hi, everyone. Today, I'd like to welcome Dr. Marnell Niles-Goins to our show. Dr. Niles-Goins is the Dean in the College of Sciences and Humanities at Marymount University in Arlington, Virginia. Hi, Marnell. So happy to have you on the show today.
Hi, Dave. Thank you for having me. It's nice to be here.
So can you tell me about your college and also why your students select your institution?
Sure. Yeah. So Marymount is located in Arlington, Virginia, which is essentially a few minutes from DC, which depends on, what part of DC you're in. So we consider it part of the DMV, which is DC, Maryland, and Virginia. A lot of our students are local, so from Virginia, DC, or Maryland, but we also have a really high international population. And Marymount is actually the most diverse university in the DMV area. And so we have other schools, bigger schools in this area, but we do have students from 73 different countries. And so one of the reasons that students select Marymount is because of its diversity. Not just in terms of race and ethnicity, but even in terms of religion, sexuality, socioeconomic status. And so when they come here, they get to be themselves because they'll find other people who are similar to them and they can be as sincere and eclectic as they want to be, and they'll find a place. The other thing is we have about 3,500 students, which is fairly small. So students also receive a lot of intimacy in terms of the classroom environment. And so, for example, students who are taking biology, for example, the stuff that they're doing in their labs are things that students at other larger universities would not necessarily be able to do until they're in graduate school. Well, because we have the faculty and the resources to be able to do it, they can kind of advance themselves a bit more, play around a little bit more in the labs, and also work with their professors on a more intimate level. So we've got smaller classroom size. We have access to the DC area. So our politics majors can just, you know, get on the metro or drive to downtown DC and see what's going on the Capitol. And so there's just so many opportunities. We require internships, and because our students have access to a lot of different venues, a lot of different people, they're able to get experiences at Marymount and still have an intimate feeling at a university that's fairly small in a way that's unique to the DC area.
Well, what's new on campus right now? I know you've started some new programs at your college, so I'm all ears.
Yes. Okay. So, well, I guess first what's new is that we're on campus. So that's great. You know, we actually were last year, we were one of the few universities in the area that were still in person. So we gave students the option to either be virtual or in person. A number of students did in person, but then after they realized that they could stay home and still be in their pajamas, mm-hmm. They switched to virtual later in the semester. But I was still walking up and down the hallways and seeing faculty teaching in classrooms with students on campus. And so that was last fall. And so what's new this semester, though, is that the virtual offerings have decreased purposely on our end. We want faculty to have a sense of normalcy. And so students are back in the classroom full force unless, of course, they've received some sort of exemption or if they're taking some classes that were already online. So that's new in a sense. I'm putting that in quotation marks because it's not quite back to normal, but at least it makes us feel as if, hey, we're back on campus. We see people sitting outside, the classrooms are full, and students are able to feel like a real life college experience again. So in addition to that, we do have new programs. We do have an English 4+1 degree. And so essentially that means that students can study English for 4 years and then stay an additional year and then get a master's of humanities. That's really exciting because sometimes students will want to do a master's degree at another institution and that requires two more additional years. And here they already know the faculty, they know the workload, and they can do an additional year. We've got an international relations certificate that's coming down the pipeline. So that'll be available for students to take starting next year. And we're hiring some new faculty to assist with that as well. That's really great for this area, number one, because that certificate is not offered at a number of schools in the area. But number two, we're DC is up the street. And so to be able to study international relations, it means that it's not just available for our current students, but it's available for anyone who wants to go back to school and do a certificate to kind of help them with whatever career choices they're trying to make. Last year, we also did leadership and ethics for criminal justice. That's a certificate as well. The reason we did that one's a little bit more nuanced, and that is specifically for law enforcement. And so we know that the environment right now for law enforcement is one that is just full of conflict and discussion. And so we met with the police chief of Arlington and the interim police chief of Arlington, who teaches adjunct for us as well. He's fabulous. And then we sat and we had a lot of conversations about some ways that we can enhance the conversation with law enforcement and with the community. And it was great. They're quite awesome and really receptive to feedback, and they'll ask us questions as well. So we developed this certificate in ethics and leadership, one of hopefully, you know, two or three that we'll develop for law enforcement in order for them to get their additional credits for work, but also to kind of help them in terms of decision-making. It's very different than what they might experience at the police academy. And so we're expecting not necessarily new recruits to take the certificate, but those who are more seasoned, who might need to kind of address some of the situations that maybe they've encountered at work over the past couple of years and just make sense of them, and then be able to kind of move forward and assist in community engagement and community relations. And so we're super excited about that. And then the last one I'll talk about, because we've got more, but the last one that I'll talk about is a biomedical engineering degree. We've got a faculty member who has put forward, he's a physicist. I call him an engineer as well, but he does a lot of 3D printing, and we'll be working with physical therapy, with our 3D printing lab, and working on biomedical engineering. Because our university is small, we want to be able to create a program that can be useful in countries besides our own. So some of the things that we do now are make, like 3D limbs for folks who might not be able to walk or have a hand because of an accident. And we've been doing that for several years in other countries. And that's quite helpful if you don't have like a lot of money, if you don't have a lot of resources, and using 3D printing is really helpful. And beyond that, teaching other people how to use 3D printers in order to make these replicas. And so as we think about biomedical engineering, we're starting that program and working in tandem with our physics faculty, our 3D printing lab, our PT faculty, in order to eventually, right now this is a bachelor's degree, hopefully eventually we'll do some graduate work in that area as well. So if you come to Marymount, you've got a lot to think about, you know, and this is just my college. And so whether it's politics or English or biology or engineering or psychology or sociology or communication, like me, you know, I'm going to toot that discipline because it's my favorite. we've got a lot of offerings for such a small institution. I'm really proud of that.
Holy cow. I wrote down 7 questions while you were talking, and we have so many things to do right now.
Yeah, so you said we have an hour. So
for me, first, you made a comment that you're actually doing less online this year than you did last year.
Yes.
That is so exciting, because I know a lot of faculty that I've talked to said, it's not the same, Dave. It's not the same. Right. And I remember seeing those faces last year, that same thing. So you actually are doing that, though. You have, while everybody else is trying to scale up for online or make more hybrids, you decided, mm-hmm. let's get them back in the classroom.
Yes. And so the reason is, I think we had a head start over a lot of other institutions because we were in person last year. in the fall. Other institutions went fully online and we were back. And we realized that that was a lot for our faculty and a lot for our students. So every class was different. And students just had to learn and ingest a lot of different teaching methods, a lot of different apps. And so some of the faculty for their classes were doing hybrid for every single class. So imagine teaching in person and also teaching online simultaneously. That's exhausting if you're doing a full course load. And so while it was great and we commend the faculty and the students for just being able to adapt, we know what that was like. And this year we can be more intentional. So if we have students here on campus, we know that they're missing that in-person experience. Come on, we're back. If you want to do an online class, you can do that as well if it's offered. But we want the faculty, if they're doing online, to intentionally say, I want to teach this class online. I prepared to teach this class online, not do it because they've got to do half online and half in person. And so we were able to learn from that. But Dave, that's the reason we were able to learn from that is because we were about a year ahead. So the classes that are online now are fewer than last year, but more than the year before pre-pandemic.
And it sounds like the faculty that are teaching this year, this is what they want to do. They've set up their class to do it online.
And the students who are taking classes online, same thing. They're intentionally taking their classes online as opposed to just, you know, I guess I'll just, you know, be in my pajamas and take the class and see how it works out.
Good for you guys. And then my background, I taught in the public safety for a lot of years, you know, fire science, criminal justice, you know, and paramedic, all those things. And I always was impressed that when you talk about criminal justice, it always seems like we were always worrying about kind of just the sociology side. We never really got, it wasn't really for the, a lot of times it wasn't ever for the working cops on the street.
Right.
At least that was my opinion of what I was seeing. And I would meet with police chiefs and they say, give us something that the guys on the streets have right now. You know, I have males and females who are asking me for this. And so that's exciting that you truly have something that will impact the working cops today.
But I have to say, you know, I didn't just make this up, Dave. The reason is because the faculty members have experience in the field, but we also met with folks. So we met with police officers, we met with officers who do training, we met with police chief, we met with the community, and the conversations were good, but if it's, hey, you want us to do something, then we have to do it, right? There are just too many conversations that provide criticism to various entities, and I am all about solutions. Like, what is it that we can offer here at Marymount to assist? And so I was really proud of the faculty for being able to put this together and offer it.
That's exciting. And did that launch last year? Is that what you said?
So it launched in the spring, like a soft launch, but officially this fall we're starting.
And how's that, how is that being received?
Good so far. And we expect more because it's a certificate.
Right.
The soft launch in the spring was great, but we actually expect more this spring because there's not like a, you've got to start in the fall in order to complete it. And so we've been in contact with the Arlington Police Department about promoting it a little bit more. So I don't know the enrollment offhand right now, but the classes are full. So that looks good to me.
Well, right on target. Oh my goodness. That's exciting.
Yeah, a lot going on around here.
And then, of course, the 3D printers, that blows my mind too. So I'm going to leave that one alone because I could just. I want to talk about you for a little bit. So can you talk about yourself and the path that led you to become the dean at Marymount?
Yes. Okay. So when I was younger, I would draw a lot. I would write a lot. And my favorite subjects were art and math. And so from the time I was a kid, I was a problem solver. And I was also the one who would get in trouble a lot. And I would get straight A's. But they didn't necessarily know what to do with me because I was bad. So even in kindergarten, Dave, I remember finishing my work early and then, you know, there's nothing to do. So why not just, you know, get into a fight? That seems like something to do. And so thinking about how that has kind of informed me in terms of like my trajectory. I've always had like lofty goals, like, all right, I'm going to get my PhD, I'm going to do this. And I've accomplished all of that. And it wasn't until I was at Fresno State, I was there probably 12 or 13 years, I, you know, moved up the ranks to full professor, that I started to think about, is this as a full professor what I want to do for the rest of my life? And I really enjoyed it. And I gave a speech to the freshmen, and sitting behind me at that time was like, you know, all the deans and the provost and the associate provost and the president. And I realized after I finished that speech and after they told me just how impressed they were, like years later, they told me like, you know, based on how you talk and how you kind of read the room and were able to adapt the speech, you would likely be good in administration, just based on that speech. So at that point, I started to think about it a little bit. I'm a native of Philadelphia. And so even being in California for 12 years, it never quite felt like home. My husband and I thought about, okay, how can we get back closer to our family? And so a job opened up at Marymount as an associate dean. I said, let me just apply for it. And I got it. I think I finished the interview. It may have been like a Thursday or Friday. And I sent the thank you letter the following day. And the dean at the time responded within about 20 minutes and said, oh, thanks so much for coming. We'd like to offer you the position. And I just paused and I was looking on my phone at the time and I called my husband and he said, we got to go. I was like, oh, okay. And so the transition was, I want to say at first it was unintentional to become an associate dean. It was a desire to move back to the East Coast. But also in the back of my mind were those things that the president and the other deans had said to me. So I was associate dean for about a year, Dave, before my dean left and became provost at another university. And I remember her telling me and getting the email. And I literally closed my eyes and prayed and said, please don't let me be dean. And the provost called, he interviewed a couple folks. And I told my husband, I said, this is too fast. I want to take my time a little bit. And then he called me in about a day and said, I would like you to be interim dean. And I said, yes. And then, you know, fast forward to, we did a major restructuring last year where we went from four schools to three colleges. And then I became interim dean of the College of Sciences and Humanities. I got new faculty. I lost some who went to another college. And then maybe a few months after that, I became permanent dean. The faculty sent a note to the provost with signatures and I became permanent dean. So I don't think that I was necessarily like gunning for the position. But once I got it, and the more I do it, the more I realize that this is what I'm supposed to be doing. Like the things that I'm doing just make sense to me. The relationships with the faculty and the students, the dealing with conflict, the creating new programs and being a visionary and talking to stakeholders, like it fits with my skill set. And ultimately, I think my skill set kind of focuses on making sense of things. And so if you think about art and math as being these very different things, to me, they're similar. It's like the reason I love math is because it's about making sense of things. And for me, like with art as well, like seeing a blank canvas and then like painting and making it turn into something beautiful, like going from chaos to, you know, a beautiful creation. To me, that's how I make sense of things. And it fits within my skill set being a dean. So conflict and chaos, like I love it because it means that we're in the creative process and moving towards something that's ultimately going to be this, you know, beautiful piece of artwork or, I don't know, completed math equation, whatever analogy you want to use. But it all fits. And it took me a while to kind of be comfortable in that.
Yeah.
And honestly, I think I'm still making sense of a lot of things, but yeah, it's part of the process, I think.
So what's been some of the biggest lessons you have learned then as an academic leader? What could you share with other new academic leaders coming in?
Mm-hmm. So the first thing is that people are going to come to you with problems. And that's the most often, so most often people will come with you not when they're having a great day, but when there's something that's happening that's a big deal, at least to them. And so the first thing is to allow people to be angry, allow people to be annoyed and frustrated, and don't take it personally. I've had faculty and students who too often come to me and say, I'm so sorry to be bringing this to you. And the first thing, I don't want them to be sorry. I want them to feel okay with bringing it to me and the tone that they need to bring it to me in, and with, you know, whatever vulnerability they want to bring, I would like them to be able to trust me with that. So I'm not going to condemn them for being angry or say, fix your tone. Like, I'm here to be able to take that and to accept it. And so I allow people to be frustrated and angry and feel whatever they want to feel, and not to take things personally, to not necessarily be averse to conflict, and to take it. But again, I'm a problem solver. And so to me, those things that come to me, it excites me in a sense, like, how can we fix this? How can we satisfy it? It's not necessarily going to be in the way that the faculty member wants it to be, but it should be in a way that we can all understand. And so people want to be heard, and it's important to not provide a solution or jump in and interrupt people's feelings as they're sharing them in their rawness. It's about listening. About understanding their problems. It's about repeating what they're saying to you so you have a full understanding of that, and then coming to a solution. I realized that faculty appreciate the transparency, even if it's not what they want to hear. So the other thing to that is to tell the truth. And so if you're not able to do something, faculty should be able to hear that. If you can do it, super. But telling the truth and often having those face-to-face or Zoom conversations also helps to alleviate a lot of negative feelings. So sometimes faculty will send me really long emails about how they're upset about things, and I just have to call them. Like, I want to be able to hear their voice. I want them to be able to hear my voice and the tone. And often that's an easier way to kind of reach a goal or, you know, or solve a problem than just going back and forth through email. So those are some of the things. And then the last one I'm sure we've all heard is just be nice. Be a nice human.
Yeah. Like, yeah. You know, I have a couple of chancellors I'd like for you to go talk to. They're popping in my mind. It's like, yeah.
Right, be nice. And the other thing, I learned this from my husband, who is just a nice human. People are going to come to you with, you know, negative tones, and meeting those tones with more negativity does not accomplish much.
Yeah.
So a lot of it is just, hey, how are you doing? All right, tell me more. Okay, let's talk through this. And so the solution is not going to be figured out right away, but at least if faculty can trust you, that helps a lot with the culture of the college and the culture of the university.
Well, you know, you've already touched on a couple of these, but my next question has to do is, what do you think are the most important qualities for someone to excel as a college dean?
Right. Yes. So, yeah, for me, making sense of things and being organized is really helpful. But those are things that a dean does every day, a chair, a provost. I would actually say be a visionary. And so these things are going to come all the time. I would recommend taking some time out away from them, from your email, and just sitting and thinking and dreaming. Because otherwise you'll still kind of have your college or your school or your university in the same place. You'll just be solving the same problems. If you can't get away from it and vision and dream about new programs or you know, wonderful things that are happening in the news in the area that you can hop on or start, or issues that you can solve in the community, then you'll continue to be stagnant. So if you stay in your email and you continue to solve like smaller or mid-scale problems, you won't have a chance to dream or envision what your university or your college could look like. And that's important.
Did you have a mentoring program that you went through, or was there something that helped you along the way here to
so
be where
I,
you are today?
I'm a bit different, Dave. And So one of the things with me, I'll say that I'll never do like those vision boards that people do, because I have been thinking about, you know, my trajectory since I was like probably 3 or 4. Like, I make lists every day. And so making a vision board would be really stressful for me, because when I make lists, I do those things. And so I have really been a self-starter from the time I was a kid. So if I see somebody on the news, or if I see someone who does something that I think I could do, I'll try it just for no good reason, but to just see if I can do it. I had an uncle who passed a couple years ago who studied communication. He was a dean for about 2 years, and then he went back to being a professor. So he was the first person that I saw in that dean position. He passed before I became a dean, but that was in my mind, like very far in the back of it. I always thought full professor was it. But after that, like there was no one specifically that I spoke with who said, hey, you should be a dean. Mm. However, I do find people, and I'll just email them. So I went to Howard from graduate school, and they have a new president now, Wayne Frederick. And I remember sitting at my desk over the summer, and I just sent him an email, or his secretary, like, hey, I want to meet with you. And then we met just so I could pick his brain about, you know, what his trajectory was like, what suggestions he had. And I've done that a couple times. I think this summer I probably met with maybe 3 college presidents and 1 chancellor. And then I also know a couple from California when I was there. I think maybe 3-4 of our provosts at Fresno State have since become presidents in the CSU system. And so I have people I can reach out to, but in terms of a specific mentor, no, not at this moment. I just run with it.
Is there anybody who's been a professional influence in mm-hmm. that helped you?
So I've got peers who we kind of go through the trajectory together at other institutions. So we may have graduated from Howard together. And so I'll talk to them about like some of the decisions that I'm making or about, you know, what I'm thinking in terms of new programs. Many of them right now are full professors. So in terms of my cohort, for example, I'm the one that's moved forward the quickest and the fastest. And so sometimes they'll come to me. At other times, I'll ask them questions. I think Kimberly Moffitt is at UMBC.
Yeah, I've talked to her.
She's the interim dean there. Sometimes we'll email each other and just bounce ideas off of each other. But nothing formal at the moment. I just find the people that I think that I need at the moment. But I'm glad you asked. So I am also running for second vice president of the National Communication Association. Mm-hmm. There's no one else running. So I'm assuming if I don't get it, then, you know, I'm terrible. But one of the things that I want to do as part of that association is create an administrators institute. We have one for chairs, but something that just really provides some mentorship for folks thinking about going into administration and just talking and providing resources for them, because I think it's needed, especially within my field.
Well, what's been your biggest challenges right now as a college dean? Mm-hmm. You can pull out the list if you want to. It's okay.
Well, you know, you've got these faculty and student problems that will come. No matter what. But I would not say that that's the biggest challenge. I think the biggest challenge likely is the challenge that we're all facing as just humans, and that's probably COVID, about managing it and the changing, like the variants, the rules, implementing the rules. And part of it is because we don't necessarily have a solution. We're going with what the CDC says, what the state says, and these change. The good news is that faculty and students understand, like, we're not just making rules and changing them willy-nilly. But for example, at first, we were inside without masks, and now we're requiring masks. And if we go back to last year, we also had 6 feet in between each person, and now those socially distant rules, we don't need them anymore if people are masked. And so thinking about that plus requiring vaccines or having exemptions for faculty and students, thinking about, you know, the rules for people, for athletes or eating in the cafeteria, I think this is the biggest challenge that that any dean would face, especially if, you know, you're thinking about what quarantining looks like for faculty and students, and if somebody gets sick, and finding replacement faculty if a faculty member has to take a couple weeks off or even a month off. And so Figuring that out in a way that still makes the college experience still really wonderful for students has been, I think, the most challenging thing that I faced as a dean.
Interesting. Well, let's talk about your research. So I see that it focuses on organizational and small group communication. So can you share some of the findings from your research? And also, what advice can you give other academic leaders regarding communication?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes. It's interesting. So I just last year published the Routledge Handbook of Communication and Gender. I'm working on a book chapter now about the experiences of Black women in group and organizational settings. So I want to actually share this one piece of research that I use. It's not mine, and I can't remember the authors either, but I shared this a lot when I was teaching graduate courses in small group and organizational communication. And this is actually going to lead to one of the things that really gets me going, and one of the things that I'm that's really important to me as a dean. And that is, this is for peer groups. So like friendship groups, for example, as children, there was a study that looked at groups of kids and how they felt stress when they were excluded from friendship groups. And they found that children who were of color, and specifically Black kids, when they felt excluded from groups, experienced far less stress than white children when they were excluded from groups. So imagine, you know, you're playing, I don't know, little kids play hide and go seek, and imagine you're excluded. The white kids felt far more stress than the Black kids. And so one of the reasons that in conversations with students and faculty about why, and this was not in the article, about why the Black kids would feel less stressed, is because often they experience more stressful, more stressful acts throughout their entire life. So when they feel this sense of exclusion, it's not anything that's more than what they've already been feeling. Another hypothesis might be because they feel that they've been excluded in other environments, that this is essentially nothing new. So for kids who are white, for example, this might be like a really big trigger because it's not something that they necessarily might be used to. So if you transition that to, the organizational setting, when these kids turn into adults, and you think about how stress is felt by various groups in organizational settings, the same thing occurs. So many times you might see people of color or Black people specifically experience a stressful act in an organizational setting, and they might just be sitting there cool, calm, and collected. It's not because if they feel okay with it, but it's because, you know what, these types of things happen all the time. I know how to handle it. I know how to manage it. And so when we think about what this looks like for faculty members, what it looks like for administrators, what it looks like for staff members, often when we're in meetings and stressful things happen, you'll see very, very different reactions. And even if a faculty member who is of color brings something that happens to an administrator or to HR, often that cool, calm, and really relaxed conversation is taken as if, okay, well, it doesn't matter, or the incident must have been okay because they don't seem so stressed about it. And so that's something that we as administrators ought to really think about when we're listening to the conversations of faculty. It's important to understand their nonverbal communication, but also from a cultural lens, and to also listen to the words that the faculty member is saying. So if a student, for example, is complaining about a faculty member, or if a student, you know, if a faculty member had something like written on their car, right, from a student, often we'll respond to the nonverbals, to the intonation of the voice, to the anxiety that we feel. And it's important that we also, as administrators, really, really listen to what the person is saying. Otherwise, it's going to be really easy to dismiss it and say, well, it's not a big deal. They weren't really worried about it because they didn't sound concerned. And for many people of color, that's quite dismissive because we can be really calm in situations that actually might be stressful to other groups. So that's just a an abbreviated version of some things that the research and small group and organizational communication means for, like, you know, deans or for other types of administrators, and how we can then make really informed decisions with our faculty and with our students and even with our stakeholders.
Is there anything you can share about one-on-one conversations?
Mm-hmm. You mean in that same,
same arena?
So it goes back to what I said in terms of accepting and understanding the faculty member in their rawness. That rawness and that vulnerability can look very different. So for some faculty members, they might be angry. For other faculty members, they might cry. For other faculty members, they may just seem really as if it's not bothering them at all. And this could be the exact same situation. So it could be, something that upper administration did. Maybe they're not getting a pay raise, or maybe a student was inappropriate in class. Whatever the situation is, whatever that triggering act is, can be felt very differently by various faculty members. So it's important that as administrators, we receive it in the same way. So yes, if you're crying, here's a tissue, but the significance of what they're saying should not be diminished because there are no tears or because there's no anger. We got to make sure that we really listen to, like, the words that the faculty members are saying. And so if there's something that needs to go forward to HR, or if there's something that needs to be fixed, then we need to address it with the same fervor that we would if the person were crying, or if they were upset, or whatever anger that they might be feeling.
Oh my goodness. You know, I'm embarrassed to say I've done that. I'm just running, you know, I've been a chair, I've been faculty, I've been an associate dean, I've been a dean. And I can remember back as a chair, if there was an issue with students, with a faculty member, they would come and talk to the chair first before they went up the line. Mm-hmm. And now I'm thinking, yeah, I've done that, where I've actually, since they didn't seem too upset, I was trying to figure out why they were coming to me instead of going, oh my goodness, they've chosen to come talk to a department chair, which is the first big giant step in their issue that they have with this faculty member. So
yes. And so I've had too many students come to me, for example, because they feel like the issue was not addressed or taken seriously.
Right.
They'll come straight to the dean because like the school director or the faculty member may not have taken the issue seriously because maybe the student just said it too casually. But again, if you think about this back to, childhood, if you think about what a stressful act looks like and how it's received, it may not be received very differently. And so here's the other thing. If you've got two students, for example, who have conflict with each other, and one student is crying and the other student is just like, this is ridiculous, it's easy to be much more sympathetic to the student who is crying. Because you can see that emotion. The student who's more stoic or who is angry may have good reason to. And so it's important to not just say, hey, this person is crying and this person's angry, so the person is crying has to be the one that's to be believed. This happens very much in terms of, I don't know, if we think about, the police activity, if we think about witnesses, this happens in the classroom as well with conflict. And so as we think about how people handle conflict differently, how people, cry. It's hard for some people to cry because they've experienced so many things in their life that they're experiencing stress is to either be angry or to just be stoic and just say, hey, here are the facts. And that's hard to win if you're just looking against, comparing it to someone who's crying. And so think about how you're handling conflict. I'm not saying you, Dave, but as we think about it, administrators, it's really important to think about our own biases, to think about the culture and ethnicity of the folks that we're dealing with, and to ultimately just be really good listeners. And
does age have anything to do with this? The person, as I'm looking back in my career now, I was just wondering if I ever played that card where, you don't seem upset, so everything must be fine. because that's what you're supposed to do. So
right. And a lot of my research, I haven't used age as much as I have race, gender. The only age thing that I tend to bring in is with, you know, children and adolescents. Okay. So up until, you know, you graduate college, you kind of bulk together. So I haven't looked at that in much detail. That'd be interesting, though, to kind of examine and see how that impacts, you know, like decision making and conflict management at a different age. Yeah.
So let's look at a little bit at the future. What do you think are going to be the major challenges and opportunities that universities will face maybe in 5 years or so?
Or so 10? The first is the value of the college experience. I think now with college being so expensive, with students being online and even just being at home, they're realizing like, what do I need this for? And also students spending more time with their families. I think that COVID has kind of given us a hard shift to realizing what's more important, and seeing people get sick and die. I think students nowadays are realizing, okay, I really need to reevaluate what I want to do here. Do I want to pay thousands of dollars for college experience? And if so, what is it going to get me? And then, you know, think about the government and student loans. Nowadays, I think that students are really rethinking what is the value of college. And as an institution, we've got to explain, hey, this is what the value is. This is what you can do. And also kind of sell ourselves in a way that's different. So certificates or badges or giving credit for work experience, for example, we've got to adapt to that and not necessarily take what we have and, like, you know, try to put a square peg in a small circle, but adapt to what the students really want. And so if you say, hey, I'm an adult and I want to come back and just do 2 years, and I've had these, you know, 10 years of experience in whatever industry it is, whether it's carpentry or just working at a hotel, we should be able to honor that and say, hey, these are the things that you've learned. And now come on over here and we'll teach you something that can help you get that promotion or help you move to a different industry should you want to do that. And so I think that's the challenge that we're facing now, this impasse, and maybe not even an impasse, maybe something that we're kind of just adapting to. How can we provide our students, whether they're first year students or whether they're transfer students or whether they're adults coming back to a college education for the first time in years, what can we do to make sure that they have jobs when they're done, but also so that they're like global citizens who are able to serve their communities in ways that they would not have known about prior to coming to Marymount?
Yeah, you know, with when you talk about return on investment, I think one of the hardest things as a student is, you know, I'm a working adult. I want to come in and get some additional training or something like that. And it just seems like since universities and colleges and everybody else worries about FTE, they just, you're right, they're trying to fit them into something instead of just trying to figure out what's best for the student to get them educated so they can continue their career.
Right. And honestly, sometimes we really want students to do, we try to promote STEM all the time, which is great, right? If you want to do engineering, do it. But Dave, if you want to do art, do art, right? If you want to be an artist and you want to paint, like, it's our responsibility to allow you as a student to be able to create the life and design the life that you want to do. And once we have accepted you as a student at Marymount, it is our responsibility to make sure that you leave here content, but also ready to serve your community. And so, yeah, you can be an engineer, you can be a biologist, but if you want to be an artist, if you want to be a writer, if you want to be a poet laureate, go ahead, because we need you to.
If here's a curveball I'm going to throw you.
Throw it.
If you had any extra budget money today, no strings attached, how would you spend it?
So a couple things. I would probably get some more equipment with engineering. With new programs comes new equipment. So I would make sure that we have new equipment for our engineering and our physics faculty. And we do have some 3D printers, but after touring a couple campuses that have more equipment. I would definitely increase our equipment for biomedical engineering. But we also have the humanities, and you know, being in the humanities and the social and behavioral sciences, I would really want, and communication again, I would really want us to get a bigger lab for our PR folks. And so that would mean getting new equipment and new cameras, allowing students who want to do news anchoring to be able to practice and do that. And even have a writing lab where our students who want to be writers could go in and work. I think one of the other things that I would do would be to really allow faculty to do more research and write grants, and I provide them with a bigger pool of money to be able to do that. They've got some really good ideas. And so while they have professional development funds, while they're able to apply for grants, I wish I could just give a faculty member like $50,000 and then just go do this really big project, bringing these kids from Arlington and DC and Maryland, bring them on campus, let them work with you for 2 weeks, and let them see what the value of a college experience is. And I mean, when I say kids, I mean like high schoolers. I would just really kind of spread Marymount more in the community and have a faculty member just, you know, as they say, go ham, just go ahead and do it and enjoy themselves. And I think that's where the faculty really thrive. Like they love teaching, they love working with the students. And if they had an opportunity to bring in additional students, they would do that.
So here's my last question.
Okay.
Do you have any favorite books on leadership that you would recommend?
Yes. So one of them that I am reading now, actually I'm almost done. I should be done, honestly, if I just sat and did it in about 10 minutes. But The Power of Full Engagement is a good one because I'm on 10 all the time. Like I, you know, from the time I wake up in the morning, get these kids ready to school, ready for school and take them to school and packing lunches to the time I'm here in the office to, you know, the time people are screaming at bedtime because they don't want to go to bed. Like I am maxed out in terms of energy often. And so one of the things that this book is about is managing energy, not time. Because if it were up to many of us, we would be slaves to email, like just solving each problem, the one thing at a time. But really, this book is good for me because it's about maintaining consistency and managing energy, renewing my time. And so I would recommend that to anyone who is in administration or who just is feeling pulled at a lot of in a lot of different directions. I've enjoyed that a lot. You've got like some of the staples, like Who Moved My Cheese? Like right. That's just, you know, just read it.
Yeah,
just read for life, yes. Right?
Yes. Well, that was fun. Thank you so much for sharing that.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure of being here. And I so thank you for the invitation. It was great to meet you and to talk to you.
You too. It was great having you as a guest. Well, that wraps up today's episode. Thanks everyone for listening.
Thanks for listening to today's episode, and make sure to visit our website at academicdean.com for additional information. Also, if you enjoy our podcast, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. Until next time.